8. Iron Shades. Chapter 20. The strike cruiser is coming in fast, piloted with its owner's habitual controlled aggression. Vaux watches it smash through the half-hearted cordon of two world-eaters frigate-class haulers and make directly for Solus. Its sable flanks glint from the flash of explosions on all sides, but it is being threaded with the determination that marks it out and sets it apart.
"Come about," Vaux orders, gauging how prepared they are for this. "Ready for defensive broadside."
Many look up at him, but only Hovik, poor, ruined Hovik, dares to speak.
"Lord, we are vulnerable," she says carefully. "Lances burned out, damage taken on both flanks."
It only takes a second for Vaux to see that she is right. He allows himself a moment of self-reproach. He had enjoyed the destruction of the Nova Cannon, and has let that colour his judgment. After so long, he ought to know better.
"Well observed," he says,
bowing to acknowledge the correction. He is not a vindictive commander.
"Move us away, then. Just a little time to get things in order."
The orders pass down the chain again, barked with somewhat greater urgency. They are being assailed from many directions, but it is the strike cruiser that causes the most consternation. It is powerfully armed for void combat, enough to trouble Solus in its temporarily diminished state. But in truth, that is not the principal cause of concern. There will be space marines on that ship, all itching to board Solus and start doing what they were built to do. If enough were landed, given all else that they have to contend with, serious and lasting damage could be caused. So they will run, for now. They will pull clear, letting the ship recover and the crew restock the guns. A little distance is called for, after which this threat can be dealt with decisively. Solus pivots somewhat clumsily, then boosts hard for the battlesphere's edge. The manoeuvre costs it more las strikes along its back, and a row of biovents takes a raking, but then it is picking up speed. Vaux watches the augurs closely. The Iron Shade strike cruiser is in full pursuit, its thrusters burning white, and it will be in bombardment cannon range shortly.
"Gallowsman," he voxes, "what state the guns?"
Dragon does not reply immediately. Over the link, Vaux hears the discharge of a weapon, followed by what might have been a wet thud.
"Starboard broadside operational in 20 minutes,
comes the voice eventually, sour as ever.
"Damn sloppy!"
Vaux winces. He does not quite approve of Dragon's robust attitude to the crew, who will be doing their best.
"Very good," he replies. "Inform when ready to fire."
They keep running. The battlesphere is still crowded, still perilous. They take more las strikes, scattering across the rear void shields in kaleidoscopes of thrown neon. Solus knocks away a little, straining against the hits, and the deck lets out shrieks of stressed metalwork. Far below, the landings are beginning on Agrippina. Kosalax has launched the planetary assault early, while the orbital zone is a long way from being secured. Vaux catches a glimpse of the big landers being disgorged from the carriers, lines of them tumbling out of their holding cages and burning away into the Forge World's methane-rich atmosphere. This is a gamble. Such impatience could deliver a hammer blow to the enemy, silencing the fixed defense lasers and opening the floodgates, or it could deliver a reprieve if too many transports are destroyed and the focus of the fleet is diverted. Vaux sees that the Blood Angels are already responding, hurtling towards the iron black continent below, as eager to get into close combat as the World Eaters are. How enthusiastic they all are, how willingly they succumb to those indulgent rages. Something feels strange about the ship. Solus is shivering as it runs. Vaux glances up at the forward viewports. He can see the press of ships thinning, the open void beckoning. They just need that small window of recovery, a moment's pause to gather Solus's enduring capacity for revival.
1, 2, 3, say Vaux's silent lips.
Clado moves. This is the moment. This is the chance. The entire ship is in confusion. The population runs from station to station, thrown from their feet and sent clattering across the decks. The Unbroken are striding out to their assigned locations, preparing for imminent boarding actions. The ship itself, that giant sleeping consciousness, is fixated on itself, on repairing what has been damaged. He goes swiftly, hugging the dark. He has rehearsed the route many times, knowing where to avoid, whom to elude. It would be noticed, even in this madness, that the surgeon is not in the apothecarian, and so he has only a little time. Cleto is thrilled. His hearts are beating harder, just as they do when he is trying out something new with the needles. In the normal run of things, he would have no chance of leading a warband this size. He is not enough of a battlefield warrior, and such things still matter to those of the old legion. Two things, though, have given him the chance. The first is Vaux's weakness. The siege master has been locked in his own obsessions for too long now, neglecting the first business of his calling. He has grown soft, melancholy, wrapped up in arts best left to the Talisman. And there is Mortarion, too. Cleto is of the same view as Dragon, who has made his displeasure with the Primarch's call evident. The great warrior monarchs of the past should have stayed in the past. This is a new age now, one in which new weapons will be needed. The second reason is all around him. All know that Solus is changing. All remark on it. All step around the changing deck layout and push aside the throbbing arterial cables. It has become commonplace, something to smile at as they idly muse on how things will end. Cleto knows very little about the mechanics of starships, but he knows very much indeed about the living body. He knows how to dominate the will and shrive the flesh into submission. He knows how to make all sentient creatures his own, to cause them agony and dole out relief in such exact processions that soon they only live to serve, to administer his desires and further his goals. Solus is becoming alive now. Solus is something he can control, and if he controls Solus, he controls the Lords of Silence. His armor is festooned with the instruments of his profession. Needles dangle from loops of tubing. Drills swing from prehensile mechanical arms. His back is weighed down by heavy canisters, all full of the choicest tinctures from his hidden vaults. Philemon likes to think of himself as a master of the occult arts, and Slurt believes himself the most creative of alchemists. But Cleto, overlooked Cleto, can match them both. They have all been consumed by their own long games and shifting allegiances. Dragon will sulk and plan, and Garstag will champ at the bit for freer slaughter, but they do not have the resolve to act decisively, not like he does. He slips down further, finding his way through paths few of the Unbroken know exist. The air becomes hotter, wetter, closer. His boots sink deep into spongy matter. The liquid pushes up to glisten on the surface. The pipes are thickly clustered here, running in bound parallel courses, throbbing with a semi-consistent rhythm. It is so much like a heartbeat now. This is where it begins. Cleto has studied these chambers over many years, probing and measuring. The walls are no longer orthogonal. They curve and sweep. They tremble when touched. He goes further, pushing against curtains of pale grey organics, and the touch leaves a sticky residue of bile against his gauntlets. The pipework is covered in threads of dark veins. The floor is sodden and bubbling. The noise of the engines has long gone, replaced by the muffled boom of that echoing proto-heart's rhythm. Flies are everywhere, instinctively drawn to the truth that Vaux has yet to acknowledge, that sentience has done more than taken root here. It has flourished and extended, burrowing tendrils of awareness throughout the entire structure of this ship, until iron is turned to flesh and adamantium to bone. Cleto reaches his destination. A big chamber, many meters high and wide, though the precise dimensions are lost in a haze of drifting corpuscles. Something vast and flabby trembles here, suspended on bowing sinews and lost amid the curls and snags of gristle. It has chambers of its own, mottled sacs that heave and relax. He gets to work. He prepares the vials and links up the various canisters. The shots will travel down his arm into the injectors that he has mounted on the back of his hands for greater control. The quantities to be employed are prodigious. Solus is a big creature, and so will have to be administered with finesse. The air changes. Flies buzz closely around him, mobbing him, crawling over the instruments. He swats a few away, feeling their fat bodies splat against his palms, and carries on. From above, he can just about detect the ongoing noises and movements of void combat, the impacts that send shockwaves travelling down deck after deck before being baffled in the sumps. Plato is ready. He takes a breath. His two hands bristle with injectors the length of a child, each one linked up to the cocktail of neurotoxins strapped to his back. It is rare that Plato prays. He has so little faith. This time, though, he whispers just a fragment, just in case anything is listening.
"Guide this," he breathes, "and I shall create such carnage in your name that the heavens will weep from it."
Then he thrusts the needles in, right up to the hilt, and the plungers slam home. Dragon is shouting. He is striding, moving up and down the long gun lines. Hundreds of crew struggle to get the machinery operational again. Some howitzers have been completely destroyed, blown into lumpy towers of molten metal and entombing their operators. Others are merely out of alignment, and their gangs haul on the rust-thick chains to bring them back onto the slide rails. Every surviving gun angles steeply upwards, rooted in the deck of the ship and pointing up to the gaping gunwales. A filigree of void shields glistens across the apertures, and it suddenly looks fragile. In combat, the gun deck is a very dangerous place to be. It is one of the primary areas targeted by the enemy, and given the need for firing orifices, a catastrophic hit will punch the atmosphere out into the void here more rapidly than almost anywhere else. This has to be done quicker. This recovery has to be more effective. Dragon has access to tactical data the Unchanged do not, and he sees the incoming predators on the long-range scans. They are already firing, sending off range-finding bow chasers, and they are gaining. Right now, Solus is toothless, slow, and vulnerable. Dragon surprises himself with his vehemence. He had never intended to work this hard for Vorks, not in this battle. It was hard to forget Typhus's injunction, and still the words ring in his mind. But combat has a way of reinforcing loyalties. This is about survival now, and he will do nothing to jeopardize it. Not here, not yet. He sees Kodad, the gunnery captain, and shoves his way over to him, pushing aside a tilting ammunition scaffold.
"We need to fire now," he growls.
Kodad nods, his face awash with muck and sweat. Bodies toil in every alcove and under every arch. From somewhere, Dragon can hear the bovine bellows of plague ogrins being goaded into action. Kodad gives the order, no doubt earlier than he'd have liked. Shouts ring out, bells clang, chains yank tight. Bulky shells slide down the runnels and clatter into the breaches. An old klaxon sounds, though it is washed out and croaky from neglect. The deck judders, throwing up its slops and scraps. Dragon wheels away as the first reports ring out. The immense barrels slam back into their housings, filling the gun deck with smoke. Spent casing fragments fly out, spinning across the deck and rocking to a halt. The crew scrambles to collect them up, to spray thick coolant onto the glowing bracings, to prepare for reload. It is impossible to know how effective the shots have been. Vorks will have a better vantage from the bridge. Dragon moves up the line, spying a crew working a little less hard than the others, its numbers thinned by earlier explosions. He draws his pistol again, preparing to apply motivation. He never gets there. Solus swings around violently. The lumens crash into nothing, then flicker on again, then out for good. Huge crashes, almighty crashes, swell up from below, making the guns shiver in their stocks. For a moment, he thinks the reactors have been hit, maybe gone critical. He has never experienced such wild dislocation, and he struggles to keep his feet. The rest of the crew are less agile and are thrown around like chaff in a thresher.
"Keep firing!"
he roars, reaching out for something to hold on to. He feels sick, strangely. He feels like he has been poisoned. The deck carries on bucking relentlessly. It feels, and this is insane, like the ship is literally trying to shake something off its back.
"Keep firing!"
he shouts again, not knowing whether anyone is heeding his commands or whether this is some terminal spiral into oblivion. He fights his way back along the gallery, clambering over the gun's tangled moorings. Dimly, he registers other data, boarding torpedoes incoming, the ship's gravity center skidding all over the place, conduits bursting open and flooding the atmosphere with sprays of acidic lubricants.
"They are getting in,"
he realizes, infuriated and impotent.
"And there is nothing now to stop them."
Clado screams. It has been a long time since he last screamed, and it makes his withered vocal cords throb. Somehow, he keeps his claws pushed down, connected with that shivering mass of flesh, and pumping fear stimulants and mind suppressants into it. The sensory inload is overwhelming, gigantic, all-smothering. Clado had no idea. He had no idea just how far Solace has grown, how powerful it has become. He stares into the ship's mind, its half-aware self, and sees an almost infinite potency there, gigantic, sullen, dull-like fog. He has a choice now. He can try to pull out, to escape with his life and sanity, or he can push on and exert his will over this behemoth. Clado fights it. His fingers squeeze on the triggers, pumping more suppressants into Solace's bloodstream. The electrodes at his temples flare, and he feels the sharp snap of pain as alien matter backfloods into his own circulatory system. They are connected now, the two of them, like a fetus in a womb. Clado has his innate strength to draw on, his knowledge and his long preparation. Solace is barely conscious, a slumbering leviathan, but it is reacting to the invasion, kicking back, wallowing up through the shallows. For a second, Clado sees the prize before him. He sees the vessel's control centers, its ganglia and its long, straggling connectors, lodged deep into every system and structure. He sees the electric glows as the protothoughts shuttle and commute between organs, regulating and feeding. He understands how it works and almost grasps what would be needed to control it. He reaches out, his consciousness traveling down those same conduits, and has the sensation of vastness, of control. Then he is in the void. He, Clado, is in the void, an immense single object flickering with a coronet of lasfire, powered by colossal thrusters that throb red like a wound. He sees the other objects flying around him, some tiny, some as huge as he is. He sees a sable strike cruiser coming in very close, loosing its cargo of fighters. He feels the scampering of the crew within him and understands that he could crush them all. A squeeze here, an exhalation there. This is horribly dangerous. This is not what he wanted. Control was the objective, not some merging of minds. Clado fights harder. Somewhere, in another far-off reality, his fingers stay tight on the plungers, pumping in more of the chemicals. The ship must be rendered dormant, quiescent, turned into something he can enslave. The pain ratchets up. Solace is aware of him. Clado can smell the intelligence there now, blind but clarifying rapidly, numbed by his injections but hard to fully extinguish. It is like a sea, deep and turgid, rolling under heavy gravity, slow but with an incredible, inexhaustible force. This has been a mistake. He has overreached, stretching out for something beyond his ability to hold. Clado has one option left, a concoction he has never tried before, a combination of neurotoxins so potent that every subject he has ever exposed to them died in immediate psychic shock. He had been keeping it in reserve, loath to use it unless necessary. But now, surely, he is out of alternatives. It is still hard to make the selection. He is losing his mind, and he can feel his poisons reverse seeping into his own blood flow. His fingers do not work as they should. His neck is searing with that hot, tight pain. Though he can no longer see, he sometimes knows that the organs around him are swelling, bloating, pressing against him and trying to crush the life from him. This has been a mistake. He forces a finger to twitch, to click down on that last switch. He can almost taste the poisons gushing, bubbling and frothing as they surge into open veins. Solace wrenches away. It jerks. It spasms. Systems shut down, gasping, and ventricles burst. Clado is hurled away from the link, the needles ripped out, doused in a torrent of inky fuel. The world swings wildly, and he cracks his head against a sparking nest of blown wiring. The ship is screaming, its thrusters gun into full burn, flinging it into a crazed spiral. Repeated thuds slam along its flanks. What are they? Impacts? Explosions? Clado is crawling now. His head is banging with starbursts, his whole body flaring with agony. He coughs up blood. He has unleashed something within Solace, some reaction that is spreading and burgeoning. In a human body, it would be burning towards the heart, choking it off and rendering it insensible. Where is Solace's heart? Where will the shock come? Clado drags himself away. He has failed badly. He does not know what happens next. Where is Solace's heart? Vaux drops to his knees. Everything is exploding. The roof collapses further down the bridge dome, crushing crew beneath its fall. The atmosphere is rushing past him, as if the ship has suffered some major breach, though no such report has reached him. Every signal he receives makes no sense. He's feeling light-headed, bleary. Solace is in agony, and a chain reaction has been set off somewhere. Vaux staggers over to an auger station and tries to understand the cacophony of signals blaring across its hololith column. The iron shades are on board, some of them at least, but Solace is now travelling incredibly fast. Cracks race across the ceiling, deep ones that score into the metal struts. He must get out, get away from that danger. The warp drives. He sees the numbers click over, faster and faster. By the God, if that does not stop soon! He lurches, going for a column that will shut everything down, flush the tubes, blow the main interconnectors, and jettison them straight into the void. As he moves, the columns collapse, the roof falls in, adamantium smashes and slams around him, and the cogitators explode into balls of static. Vaux smells the warp and sees the unshuttered real viewers go white. He tries to get away, but the entire bridge is falling in around him.
"Gallowsman!"
he voxes, just as the first beam crunches into his helm. He goes down hard, more impacts landing. Blood runs down the inside of his helm.
"The warp drives," he thinks.
Then he's gone. He's out, silent amid the falling wreckage.